Welcome to Compromising Positions. I'm Leanne Potter, cyber anthropologist and head of security operations for a major retailer.
And I'm Jeff Watkins, a cybersecurity enthusiast and CTO for a major tech consultancy. Together, we're the tech podcast that asks non-cybersecurity professionals what we in the industry can do to make their lives easier.
And help make our organizations more prepared to face ever-changing human-centric cyber threats.
In this episode, part one of a two-parter, we're joined by Damiano Bal, head of design at Ardoc, lecturer and international speaker on all things design and data.
In this episode, FUD Off, Cybersecurity Awareness Beyond Compliance and Boredom, we will learn from Damian about the importance of storytelling, the difference between game theory and gamification, what accessibility champions get so right and lean security gets so wrong, and how to design a security awareness program that resonates with people and encourages empathy and behavioural change.
FUD, fear, uncertainty and doubt. They've been a mainstay in cybersecurity messaging, but is it serving us or is it just turning people off our messaging? Find out in this episode if there's another way and if we should just tell FUD to FUD off for good.
Does this mean I can start doing cyber stand-up like I've always dreamed of?
We agreed in the episode, Leanne, as long as it's not cheesy, then yes, you can make cyber jokes.
I've got a bit of stage fright now. Okay, I've got one. Why did the cyber security expert break up with the password?
No, no.
Because it wasn't strong enough.
I think in your case, Leanne, let's just stick to FUD.
Wait, I've got another one. Why did the firewall blush?
I don't know.
Because it saw too many packets.
Right, anyway, we love this chat and we think you will do too, if you're still with us after those jokes. So sit back and enjoy the first part of our two interviews with Damiano Bal. Today, in this episode of Compromising Positions, we have a very special guest with us, Damian Obal, who is currently the head of design at Ardoc. We first met Damian when we were at Webinale Berlin, talking about the UX of data, which was an absolutely fascinating talk. So we thought we absolutely had to bring him in to speak with us on our podcast. Welcome, Damian.
Welcome, Jeff. Welcome, Leanne. Thanks for having
me. Hi. No, thank you. And as Jeff was saying, I remember seeing your talk and being incredibly impressed by it, not just because it was absolutely beautiful, the slide, but it was informative, funny, and really thought-provoking. Do you want to tell the audience a little bit about yourself and maybe tell them a little bit about that talk? Because I was really inspired after I saw that talk as well.
Oh, now I'm going to blush remotely. That's what you get when you're the only designer talking to developers and engineers, folks from different domains. But yes, I'm originally from Slovenia, living in Norway for the past 6 years, heading the design team, as Jeff was saying, at Ardoc. It's a small team of 13. My background is between research, mainly qualitative user research and design. So I've been kind of walking the line there. And yes, I've been working a lot with data, with the unsexy part of the design industry, which for some weird reason is really attractive to me. I've been spending a lot of time, yes, explaining the, for example, user experience of data, which we discussed in Berlin, for example. So kind of this combining this two topics.
And why do you think it's really important to really make a story with data?
It's important and almost a given, but it's also much easier nowadays. And I think that's the most exciting for me, at least, because data is much more accessible, like this democratized access to data, which is, of course, also comes with its downsides, as, for example, I keep talking about this democratization of data, but it's still on the positive. I think it's great if you want to tell a story with data, so you can get the quantitative input, the data points to support, for example, if I put my researcher hat on. If I do qualitative research, it's usually the why, when you do user interviews and you go deep. But then with data, with quantitative data, you can get the other part of the story, and then you, what do we call, like the triangulation. So when you use mixed methods, and then kind of you come to the gist of it. But the story, what you mentioned, Leanne, I think it's really important, like how you tell a story, kind of course twist the story. And people say data never lies. Of course it does, if you kind of extrapolate it. We are very good as designers, we are very good at sometimes manipulating the story, so we are to blame. But I think it's very important that you kind of show it in a story-like format, so not to burden the consumer on the other end, whoever that is, your stakeholder, your team. So just kind of as you would read a story to your kid, it's kind of it's very important.
No, I totally understand that. That's really good to be easy here, and it's nice to have some acknowledgement that the data never lies is quite a fallacy. You're also currently a lecturer as well, teaching others your craft, which we will do. we'll definitely open your brain up and see how we can steal some ideas from you there. But you've also got a PhD in game design and interactive media design. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's something I don't mention it often, and it's mainly because it's officially game theory, interaction design, but it's actually part of computer science. So when I said yes, I have a PhD, and then you need to explain where from, and I said, yeah, computer science. It's like, oh, so you have an engineer. It's like, yeah, on paper. So I spent this amazing time during my PhD studies. It's in Slovenia and Finland. So it has split, but I spend my time there surrounded with embedded systems engineers and fellow students. I was the only designer in this human computer interaction domain. So it was a blast. I really, really enjoyed it. And that's where I kind of came in touch with gamification, and then also the core game theory and how to apply it when designing for interaction. So it's really fun. And that's why I keep saying for interaction, not in designing interactions, because what we've been doing was creating the spaces for discussion through technology.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I still hear the term human computer interaction, because I remember I did human computer interaction 26, 27 years ago, a long time ago now. And I feel that a lot of universities hang on to that type. Do you think it should, maybe that needs an update? And this is a complete side quest of a question.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a super good point, because it also tells about our age, right? I remember when I started, it was human computer interaction, and it was usability engineering. So UPA was the kind of the mothership where we would gather the engineers on the design side. And then came UXPA, so the renaming, like user experience practitioners, and then came like IXDA, Interaction Design Association. But HCI stayed, and I think it's actually good. Not disagreeing, but I think it's good. It's kind of like respect your elders, and it's the fundamentals are there, like human computer interaction. We might interact with systems, with invisible systems, but it's kind of a machine. So I don't think it should change. And designers, especially, we are very good at design theorists. We're very good at changing. So we go from user-centered design to human-centered, and now planet-centered and ecosystem-centered. It's great. So we feel the need to evolve, whilst I think like the core of computer interaction is still valid, at least to me.
So you also mentioned about studying game theory, which I think is really fascinating. I know very little about it, but when I've sort of opened a book and gone, oh, that sounds really interesting. What principles of game theory can you apply to your role?
That's a good question, I guess, especially when we talked about gamification, for example, and then people think it's, oh, that's game theory, but it's not, right? So it's kind of a bit much different. It's more like the art of war, if you want. Like the game theory is much more with psychology and then connected to behavioral economics rather than gamification, even though what we apply, it's different. So what do we take from it? What I take from it is, how do you change users' behavior through, for example, impacting their outcomes, the desired outcomes through change in behavior? So that's the elements, at least, that we usually take. And that's at least what I apply. Can go, of course, like borderline to dark patterns, but that's when you have this like Peter Parker moment, like great power comes with great responsibility.
Another area where quite often I'd say the team that wants to change behavior, but isn't necessarily as equipped to change behavior is cybersecurity teams. You know, a lot of what they do is around, arguably should be around behavioral change. What's been your experience with cybersecurity teams, and where has it been sort of challenging? What's been good?
Yeah, that's a good point, because as soon as you, it's very fresh still. So I started and the new job 3 weeks ago. So I went through the training, right? It's almost like, okay, you need to change behavior, how you treat certain things and how you think about security. And it's definitely trying to do a behavioral change. In general, my experience with cybersecurity teams has been like a very typical, like good, so-so, and of course the horrible. but especially like in the recent past, it was very good, to be honest, because they have been like changed the tune a bit. So it's much more human. So
that's,
you would
good.
Meet your CISO. And I think it's really, and then they, of course, like in the past, it was the usual, like, you can't use Miro, or you can't use Figma, you can't send links. It's like, there's no why. And then, for example, working with a consultancy, then you have like the worst experience when you get your laptop and there's absolutely nothing on it, and you need to wait like 3 weeks to get anything installed. And then it goes into this black hole, and there's like 7 people in the email thread you need to kind of justify. So I think it's like there's a middle ground, but especially with the IT companies as of late, I don't know, you two know better, but it's kind of this federated security team, it's kind of present, it's kind of nudging, as we call in in behavioral economics would be like nudging, kind of trying to kind of tell us, hey, it's actually important. So I think there's really good improvement, and especially in my past experience, more recent experiences.
I'm really glad to hear that you think that the industry is getting better. I personally do as well. I think
it
really depends on the organization, I think. I think sometimes if you're in a bit more of an old school organization, those old school kind of mentalities persist. But I think two things that sort of struck me from what you were discussing there was, one, the why, knowing why things have been done the way they are. Yeah, you can't access this, but why? And I think we're not great at answering that question as a security function. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that really struck me is considering everyone's user journey. So I know for a fact, you know, that there is definitely a hierarchy usually in an organization between these are my permanent people, these are my contractors. And actually the contractor experience can be so awful, which is mad because obviously day rates are very expensive and we should probably try and get you guys as productive as possible, as quickly as possible to really get value out of that. Yeah, I've known in other organizations, contractors just taking weeks and weeks to get access to things and not being treated like a legitimate user and with extra suspicion. And I can understand with good cause why there might be a little bit more suspicion, but why would you hire someone if you didn't think they were going to serve you in some sort of way?
I think that's a really interesting point because we go through the same background checks. We also go through the same mandatory training. You know, when I used to work with retail banks, I used to go through all the training, all the background checks, all of the same stuff, and then get given a desk and say, you can't have a PC for 2 weeks. Like, oh, okay, that's good. You are still paying my day rate though.
Exactly. No, but it's also like because you mentioned, both of you mentioned like the why and the context. I think sometimes we try to kind of extrapolate security and kind of slap it on top, like an afterthought, or you need to do everything in advance. In both cases, it's out of context and you don't understand the why. And that's why with the trainings, for example, a lot of times they're really engaging and great. But in my experience, the best ones were, for example, when you're talking about gamification, when you kind of do like, for example, the attack trees exercise, it's like so silly. I don't know if it's good or not. You two know better, but I really liked it. And it was still stuck with me and it's been years now. I still remember the exercise. It was relevant to my team and we kind of...
Just for the benefits of our listeners, Jeff, do you want to just run through one? Attack tree is.
Yeah, so an attack tree starts with an end state you'd like to get to, and that might be my example gives is we have got money from the casino, and then you go down that tree and say, well, what are some of those methods for getting money from the casino? One of them might be getting really lucky, one might be cheating the game, one might be sneaking into the vault, one might be holding the tills up at gunpoint, and you see none of those are particularly technical things, and actually a lot of the elements don't have to be, and sometimes you can add like a path cost to that, having a whole squad of people come in with machine guns to steal something from casino, that's going to be quite expensive. And I think there's also one, Microsoft used one called threat trees as well, but it is like the topic of things like attack trees and I'd say the less technical side of threat modeling is something we talk about quite a lot, isn't it, Leanne? And I think it's really valuable to get everybody involved. It's that shift left security. It's not shifting left time-wise. It's into like getting everybody involved in how do you design a system to understand its security posture.
And it's so nice to hear that you actually enjoyed that process. What did you actually enjoy about it?
So I enjoyed, like I said, because it felt relevant. So it was kind of a given task to the team. It was relevant because it was relevant to the whole team. If you work on something, for example, releasing a new feature or developing a new user journey, then it kind of gets closer to the end user, but also thinking about all these things, like how could we lose our data? And then someone coming in with a USB stick or like someone forgetting to turn off their computer, things like that. And it was much more relevant than, I don't want to sound negative, but it's much more relevant than, you know, CEO in your security video. And it's just silly. And sorry to say it, but I think it's kind of, security is not childish. It's not supposed to be super fun. It's great if we can make it more engaging, but it's not like a black and white. And I think like security should be treated seriously. And if you give this example, then people feel like, yeah, it is a serious thing, but we can still approach it with a game-like method. And then you can gamify. What we did then was competing, like who would come up with the most like crazy scenario. So you can still make it fun, and that's great. But don't just do it for the sake of it. I think that's why I enjoyed.
I'd love to think the way you made it fun was like, and then we used a grappling hook to get inside the building, just like an old school kind of Mission Impossible. Then we cut through the glass and then we got in and then we connected to the network. There we go, done it.
Exactly. But those are like the videos are like that, right? So it's kind of like, it depends to me at least, if it's something you do and then you're creative, you do your own storyboard and that's it. For example, now the designer in me is talking, but that's how you make it like engaging. But if it's something, you know, like a video, it's kind of, and then you slap your CEO hero's face and saying like, someone came into our building. It's like, that's not fun to me.
Yeah, I'm always, when I'm designing security awareness programs, really worried about the cheese factor. My internal cringe is going, then I use that as my barometer for this isn't going well. But I think there is an opportunity to inject humor. I read a study, and I'll put in the show notes, and one of the main ingredients that cybersecurity loves to use is something called FUD, which is fear, uncertainty, and doubt. So we use a lot of that in our narrative, you know, like, don't click on that because this bad thing will happen, and you can't trust anyone. And those narratives, this study was saying, work to a point, but actually when they flipped the narrative to be more humorous, and they said using things like cartoons, memes, and things like that, and be more lighthearted in their approach, actually the behavioral takeaways you wanted your audience to have were much more salient and stuck around for much longer. But there is definitely a line to cross between being entertaining and just being the dad joke in the room trying to make everyone laugh. And I would love to, from your design perspective, what could, you know, you've literally just said you've done a security awareness training course. Have you had free reign to design a training awareness course? The first video you get as a new employee that you have to watch, what would it include?
Yeah, that's a good question. Definitely, to go a bit slower, and if you can kind of almost like drip feeding, so it doesn't feel like it's in the one take everything. And then how to make it relevant? That's going back to what I was saying before. So is it part of, for example, the product onboarding? And they say like, hey, we care about security because, for example, like when our CISO was saying yesterday, actually saying like, because we are SOC 2 compliant, this kind of it's good for business. And that's like, yeah, that's relevant. I want us to succeed. So it's kind of like, why is it relevant? Like, why should we care? It's super cool if there's cartoons and it's cool, but how can we make it a habit? That's what if I would design it, it would make it a habit, part of a product development life cycle, for example. So we kind of think about it all the time, but not being burdened by it. It's not the right, it's not how to design it, because ideally you don't have to design it, because it would be in the onboarding process. It would be part of it. And then you starting to work on the job, then you would be aware. But of course you need like this head start, nothing else, for the audits and stuff. So we need to say like, our employees are compliant. Of course we need to do that.
That's it, isn't it? Predominantly, most organizations see the security awareness training as a tick box exercise because most things require it to be so. And so there isn't as much investment in it as they possibly could be, because really the outcome of that security awareness training is to just be compliant. I don't think when people are designing these things, they have good intentions, don't get me wrong. The good intentions is, yes, we'd love people to be more aware that you need a strong password, don't click on that, things like that, fine. But that is not the primary purpose of that training, in my opinion. And so that's when you see bad design being used. I also think what you were saying before about micro interactions, streamlining it down a bit, when we design security awareness courses, it's for such a broad audience, and it's always going to fail that. When you're trying to meet, you know, the very technical people in the organization, contractors, and then maybe someone who does a bit of admin occasionally, and you're trying to bridge that whole gap of every single threat that could possibly happen in your organization, it's going to fail from the start. And I'd love to know your opinion from both a design and data, because I'm sure you agree that the data doesn't fit everyone as well. There is always going to be outliers.
Exactly. And it's also when you look at for example, from a design perspective, we always start like when we build the journeys, we say for whom, even before the why and the how, it's like, for whom are we doing it? So, and then if we want to optimize, for example, security training, like who is it for? And of course, you cannot do it for every single individual, but there is a generic baseline. But we're probably insulting a lot of engineers with the generic, like funny exercises. It's fun to me. I'm the designer in the room, but it's probably insulting the intelligence of some other people in the room. So I would always, if possible, like for whom, and then what's the kind of moment in time? For example, if you onboarded, what's the absolutely necessary to do? And then you kind of like with time, for example, can we tie it in the life cycle of a company or a life cycle of development? And then you say, okay, we are releasing something new. Did we think about security? Or we are using a new tool. Do we always need to go to our CISO and the office to ask, or can we have an educated guess? And then we kind of educate employees and like, hey, did we think about, even before applying for this new tool, like, did we think about the repercussions? Or we want to user testing. We are always to blame. It's mainly with not so much security, but with GDPR and all the new regulations. And that was like a big challenge for designers, for example. When we've been talking to people and sharing stuff, and then suddenly, you know, like sharing quotes, and it's like, did you ask that person for approval? It's like, oh shit.
That was really tough. I mean, even just nowadays, doing a dissertation, if you've got research to be done, there's a whole raft of consent forms you have to fill out, and how you're going to process and store data. I mean, generally, it's a good thing. So you kind of mentioned that, like, compliance and security could both provide, I'd say, blockers if they're not being properly engaged. What do you think the sort of cybersecurity and compliance teams could do to make your life as a designer easier? How can they enable you so you don't make the mistakes and create a blocker?
That's a good one. Especially like I have a dialogue, I think it's the most important. So it's not a straight no. I'm grateful. It is in the recent experience, like it changed a lot. So, but I had quite bad experience in the past when, for example, it's like basic things. For example, we want to do behavioral analytics, or we want to track users, but we don't have the user as a in our meta model, for example. So we can't because of security. It's like, okay, but then we need to make a decision. So, and then it's like a hard no. No, we're not gonna. We don't need the user concept, for example. And that was coming from security. If they're more kind of, if we go more to the left, so if they can come more to the right, to kind of meet us in the middle, that's great. So it's kind of, you put a face on security. I think it's very important. So it's not just an IT team that's, you know, like hidden behind a chatbot or like behind the request a Jira ticket. And that's a lot of times, in my experience with security, that's how it feels like. File a ticket, and then it's like almost like a machine coming back at you. So if there's an actual phase, that's so much for us designers, that will make my life easier. Because it's like the funny videos and a chatbot, for example. It's like, why isn't there anything in between?
Yeah.
But that's a lot of times the experience. Like, we are super fun and casual, but then just Jira ticket.
Yeah, I can definitely see how that would be quite a disconnect. You know, I have to admit that I'm probably guilty of sometimes doing that myself, as on the one side doing what I would call kind of humorous presentations and things like that, saying, hey, this is why you should care, or doing other little things like that, and then being like very business, like, right, okay, this is what I need you to do, now fix it. And I just think, I wonder, so you've kind of got me thinking about my own kind of behaviours. What could I possibly do to kind of marry that? And I guess it's literally the title of the podcast, Be More Compromising. Just like you said, meet literally in the middle.
But that's, for example, like my recent experience, for example, like the security, the CISO coming, meeting the team, that was, for example, happening yesterday. So we were mapping out the journeys, and he's using our product internally for audits, for example, which is super fun to see. It's not the point of the product that we're building. But then, like, you know, him coming and kind of sharing an anecdote about like how he uses the product, for example, and then it's like the, you know, it's the CISO, it's like the guy, you know, like if you don't do your trainings, he's the guy. But it's like, it's super nice. You're kind of, you know, descending from the drone. It's like, hey, I'm a normal person, but I care about security. And then kind of sharing like, why do I care about security? And it's like, man, that's relevant. I can relate to that. And it's kind of, if there's more of that, I know it's not scalable. That's why I like, I think that's one of kind of the recent happenings in the, or trends in security that I've seen, is this distributed ownership or stewardship. So it's kind of, we will have champions in departments, and I've seen that work really well. So it's almost like, you know, there's what's that, like fire hazard and like security on the workplace. It's kind of like, yeah, I care about security. I think it's really good to see if it's kind of more distributed, so it's not just one person. As you both know, it's probably hard to scale and justify scaling the security team.
It is really hard to scale, but I think it's worth the return on investment. And I just sometimes wonder if security teams don't realize that the benefits of doing that really outweigh, and it can be very easy to get into the mindset of, you know, there isn't very many of us in an organization, you know, it's usually one of the smaller sections of the IT team, there isn't much time in the day to be able to have oversight over everything. But I think if you identify your key areas, that, you know, the crown jewels of the business, and really invest in that by being very present, by literally being a face to a name rather than a title, I think that can be really beneficial.
Exactly, to your point, Liana. It's also, because I think we briefly touched upon it, like if you democratize it and you make it part of it, I keep comparing it, for example, to accessibility. You don't have usually an accessibility practitioner in the team, but at least every designer, every front-end engineer thinks about it. There were some huge fines slapped on really big companies, and that helped kind of to kick our butt. But now we're all thinking about it and we make it part of our process. So are we WCAG compliant, for example? It's kind of, again, like a checklist, but we're thinking about it and we don't have a certain person doing it. So everybody's doing it. And what about if we could make security feel like that? That would be great.
And you're not the first guest to make that link between accessibility champions and security. And it just makes me think, doesn't it, you, Jeff, that maybe we should probably get an accessibility person in so that we can actually learn from them.
Yeah.
Because
how did that make that stick?
Yeah, their profile in an organization has gone up. And like you say, they've had a lot of fines, but for security, to be honest. But there's definitely the way we're approaching it. And when I say where, I'm talking very general as an industry, I'm not highlighting anyone there, but how we're approaching it compared to accessibility, when both objectives are front facing, to be honest. You know, our customers are deeply impacted by our actions, whether that be security or accessibility, so we really need to be mindful of that and give that the proper importance in an organization.
It's super interesting because I think somehow accessibility, maybe the storytelling is better as an industry for that, because the actual fines, comparatively speaking, compared to say like a GDPR breach fine or you know, an ICO or an FCA breach fine, which are absolutely enormous. Most of the time in the UK, there haven't been too many actual, most of the stuff's been settled out of court, and that court settlement has been fix your site so it's accessible, you know, fix your app so it's accessible. Yet in cybersecurity, where the stakes are much higher, it feels like people aren't as bought in. I mean, I guess some of it might be, imagine with accessibility, sometimes you can't at least visualize it. How do you think we could actually make cybersecurity more tangible and visual for people who should care about it?
That's a good point. Exactly. Accessibility is, it's, at the end of the day, it's an easy sell. And that's coming from research, and it's like, it's very close to my heart, but it's also sometimes it's come on, it's so cheesy, but it's, you know, like, it's great to design for visually impaired, but yeah, are they really our users, for example, and a lot of enterprise products, and I'm fully on board, but sometimes I hear from my own designers, like, come on, like, let's just ship something and we're gonna fix it, don't worry. But security, it's never, I haven't seen anyone being so passionate about it. That's back to the storytelling. How can we kind of make it tangible and create empathy around it? Maybe because it's so abstract, because it's so alien to most of us. It's kind of like, okay, how can I? I'm just a normal worker, you know? And then we try to do this like videos. Yeah, so don't use USB sticks. Of course I don't use USB sticks. It's kind of this detachment from like extremely silly and something that, I can't do this. And then I'm assuming that people with access to AWS servers, they know security. But it's actually when breaches happen, it's probably people like me that are to blame. So how can you tell the story? I think it's by, again, anecdotal evidence and kind of not dumbing it down, but kind of making it in chunks. So it's kind of in this digests. So for example, sharing nuggets about, hey, this is also security. Like, did you know? Like research is very good. It's, for example, what we do is like we share on weekly wins. We share like, we interview this customer. That's the quote in a kind of this small nuggets. And back to accessibility, that's what you do. So like, oh, see, they're struggling. And like you create empathy for the cause. So how can we create empathy for security? Maybe I mean like far-fetched, but if we can kind of make it more, like we discussed, more relevant. So I can relate as a normal non-security person.
And I think that's really important, that empathy piece of that. There's an organization, I can't remember, maybe if I do, listeners, I'll put it in the post notes. There's an organization, their security team actually interviewed their customers. I think it was some sort of financial organization, either loans or actual banking. And they got customers who had been breached, either, you know, bad passwords or, you know, scammed, whatever. They'd lost money. And then they shared those videos around their employees. And it really made people think, actually, we need to design things better. We need to make people, even our customers, aware, which is, you seldom really see a lot of attention paid to that actual element as well. It's not just the internal employees, but actually, you know, unless you're someone highly regulated like banks, which has a duty to kind of protect customers in a much more extreme way due to regulations, you don't really see that kind of trickling down of information either, and making everyone have a better baseline of awareness.
It's a good point, though, because it's also, we share those stories, like when you win a customer, you lose a customer, or if we're in product development, like we learn from our failures. So we do like the post-mortem, for example. It's equally important than the PRD, like the product requirements document. It's kind of like, what did we learn from it? Like, it failed, but this is what we learned. I think you raised a very good point there. Can we bring those voices in? And we call them like the voice of a customer a lot of times. But it's usually like high five moments. Like, we bought your your product because of that. But if they share some negative experience, I think that's super powerful. That's a really good way. It's not cheesy because people can relate.
What a charismatic guest.
Yeah, now you know I had to keep this one as a two-parter.
Yeah, I knew when we first met him that he would be a fantastic guest on the show, and he has certainly proved it. What was your favourite takeaway?
I think it was the piece around the comparisons between accessibility champions and security champions. I know you've got a lot to say about whether or not security champion programs work, but there are certain things we can learn about how accessibility got a lot of buy-in from the business and put quite high on the build agenda.
I think if we did a word cloud for this episode, why would be the biggest word, and for a good reason. I don't think we really get beyond the surface of why in security. It's why's like, because I said so, because it'll make us more secure, because it meets our compliance obligations. I just don't think are good enough anymore.
Yeah, and I think that's where techniques like the five whys are useful to implement here, to help you really get down all the way to your motivations.
For our listeners who may have not come across the five whys, it's a technique to help you find the root cause by asking why five times. So each answer you give will prompt another why until hopefully you'll get to the root cause of the problem.
It's a good method and I really recommend people start trying it out. Well, that was good for a first part. What can people expect from the second part, Leanne?
A whistle-stop tour of design principles to apply to your security awareness program and the dangers of gamification.
Sounds good. Links to everything Damian discussed in this episode can be found in the show notes. And if you like the show, please do leave us a review and share on LinkedIn or in your teams. It really helps us spread the word and get high-quality guests like Damian on in future episodes.
We hope you enjoy this episode. See you next time. Keep secure and don't forget to ask yourself, am I the compromising position here?